This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yiswu Heeman, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir returned home from Uganda late Thursday after attending President Yoweri Museveni's inauguration. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court, and Uganda's failure to arrest him has sparked outrage.
That's Elizabeth Pollard reporting from Kampala. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, the rescue of over 800 migrants off the coast of Sicily over the past 2 days is emblematic of a new strategy by those desperate and determined to escape their war-torn native countries and enter Europe. Religious leaders from Egypt's two main faiths joined forces to help protect children, and over 1,200 political and business leaders are attending the World Economic Forum on Africa in Kigali.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir returned home from Uganda late yesterday after traveling to Uganda for President Yoweri Museveni's inauguration. Bashir is wanted by the ICC, and Uganda's failure to arrest him has sparked outrage. Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala.
Uganda greeted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir with flowers, according to local media, after his plane arrived in Kampala Thursday for the inauguration of longtime President Yoweri Museveni. The Sudanese community in Uganda reacted with shock. Bashir has been wanted since 2009 by the International Criminal Court on charges of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide in Sudan's Darfur region. This man fled to Kampala from Darfur that same year.
It was sad, actually. It was sad, like you see him just moving free. But again, at the end of the day, even if, like, the scenario like Bashir in Hague, what about the people in the IDP camp? Like, you talk to them as, like, you know what? Yeah, it's good to see Bashir behind bars. But again, what about the people who lost their lives? I mean, what about the people who lost their houses?
The conflict in Darfur, which began in 2003, is still considered ongoing, with humanitarian organizations often barred from the region. Bashir has continued to travel freely around parts of Africa, riding a swell of defiance vis-a-vis the ICC among some leaders. Western diplomats walked out of Museveni's inauguration Thursday as the Ugandan leader railed against the court, calling it useless in his speech. The U.S. State Department said the walkout, which included the American delegation, was an appropriate reaction. Uganda is a signatory of the Rome Statute, meaning it is obligated to arrest those wanted by the ICC. Mossad Muhammad Ali is the executive director with the African Center for Justice and Peace Studies in Kampala.
During the different African Union summit, you know, as they talk a lot about the withdrawal from the ICC. Yeah. Although, as you mentioned, you know, before, Uganda is one of the big supporters, you know, to the ICC. Even, you know, he asked for the cooperation of the ICC in order to investigate even, you know, the crimes that have been committed here in Uganda, you know, by Alaria and others. However, now we witness, you know, this change, you know, in the different positions of the different leaders. And now it's mostly seen, you know, by his statement yesterday morning.
South Africa came under fire last June for allowing Bashir to leave the country during an AU summit there, despite a South African court order to arrest him. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
As Elizabeth Pola reported, the U.S. State Department commented on yesterday's protest during Mr. Museveni's inauguration. Here's what Department spokesperson Elizabeth Trudeau had to say at yesterday's briefing with reporters.
We believe that walking out in protest is an appropriate reaction to a head of state mocking efforts to ensure accountability for victims of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, particularly when his country has committed to accountability as a state party to the Rome Statute. While the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute, which is the treaty that established the ICC, we strongly support the ICC's efforts to hold accountable those responsible for genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes in Darfur.
That was U.S. State Department spokesperson Elizabeth Trudeau in Washington. She was commenting on the walkout of the U.S. delegation attending the inaugural ceremony of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. And in the latest reports from Uganda, an aide for leading opposition leader Kizza Besigye told VOA today that he has been charged with treason in a court in the northeastern town of Moroto. His aide says he's due to appear in court again on May 25th.
In the DRC today, the French news agency reports police pushed back several thousand protesters surrounding a courthouse where opposition leader Mosi Katumbi is appearing before prosecutors. Katumbi is in Lubumbashi. He is answering questions about his political activists and the hiring of security personnel. The government has accused him of hiring mercenaries, which he has called a grotesque lie. There have been daily protests at the courthouse. Today, police used tear gas to disperse the crowds. AFP reports dozens of lawyers showed up to offer Katumbi their legal services for free.
European naval vessels have been very busy in recent days rescuing migrants trying to make their way from North Africa to Europe. More than 300 of those migrants and refugees have arrived in Sicily, while the rest are on their way. However, there's confusion over where the migrants came from. Reporter Antonella Sferraza is following developments. From Palermo, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the rescue operations.
We are talking about 1,000 migrants rescued last night in the Sicily Channel. Some of them ferried to Sicily, and they already disembarked in the ports in the eastern coast of Sicily. The other ships carrying the migrants will arrive in Sicily and in other Italian ports tonight. They will be arriving soon. Some of them will arrive also in Palermo, 170 expected in Palermo. All the others should go in Calabria and somewhere else. We still don't know exactly where they will be ferried. There is a bit of confusion about their nationality, in the sense that this morning the UN Agency for Refugees said that they were mainly Syrians. But 1 hour after this news, the Italian officials say there was a mistake and that there are mainly sub-Saharan. So there is a bit of mystery about their nationality, and we will know a little bit more when they arrive in the reception center and when they will be identified.
If there are a lot of Syrians that have been rescued, it could mean that they're hiring smugglers in Greece and making their way across the Mediterranean to try to enter Europe through Italy, since they can no longer use Greece to cross into Macedonia and beyond.
This is exactly what is happening, according to the analysts. You have to consider that in the first month of this year, only 26 Syrians have arrived in Italy. But with the closure of the Balkan route, all the analysts say that now Syrians will try to make their way to Europe through Italy. And all the authorities are waiting for this new migrant wave. But we don't know if this wave has already started or not, because, as we said before, there is a lot of confusion about the nationality of the people rescued today. And we can also suspect that the Italian authority want to calm the public opinion that fears that now, together with all the sub-Saharan migrants, the Syrians will arrive here. So we need to wait a little bit more to know more details.
That's reporter Antonella Sferraza from Palermo, Sicily. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The International Organization for Migration says more than 187,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea between January 1st and May 8th, with well over 1,300 fatalities.
In other news about Europe's migrant crisis, a new British report says the EU effort to disrupt human smuggling across the Mediterranean is failing. A British House of Lords committee has released its findings on the Operation Sophia search and rescue mission. It's a year-long effort to confiscate and destroy the smugglers' wooden vessels. However, the smugglers have simply turned to inflatable rafts, which are more dangerous. Meanwhile, Frontex, the EU border agency, says the number of refugees arriving in Greece from Turkey has dropped 90% from March through April. The decline is due to an agreement with Turkey to shut down the once popular Aegean route to Europe. EU and Turkish ministers are meeting today over an issue that could threaten the deal. Turkey wants visa-free travel for its citizens in Europe in exchange for closing the Aegean route. However, the EU first wants Turkey to narrow its definition of terrorist so as not to include journalists or activists. Turkey's president has refused.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Religious leaders from Egypt's two main faiths have joined forces to help protect children. They've issued a joint publication that addresses 11 forms of violence experienced by children in Egypt and around the world. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The publication is called Peace, Love, Tolerance: Key Messages from Islam and Christianity on Protecting Children from Violence and Harmful Practices. Grand Imam and Sheikh of Al-Azhar, Dr. Ahmed At-Tayyib, writes that fulfilling children's rights is one of the key pillars of Islamic law. He says it's a matter of safeguarding religion, the soul, mind, our offspring, and prosperity. Pope Tewodros II, Pope of Alexandria and Patriarch of the Holy See of St. Mark, writes that children are a gift to humanity. He says they are evidence of God's love and are like flowers in our lives. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was part of the joint effort. Dr. Peter Salama is Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa.
UNICEF has had a long and very productive relationship with religious groups in Egypt, actually dating back to the 1980s.
He says that long-term relationship led to this cooperative effort.
The key religious groups actually working together to address violence against children. And here I'm talking about all forms of violence. Of course, the headline violence that we read a lot about in the Middle East, issues such as the killing and maiming of children in the many wars and conflicts across the region, issues such as the recruitment of children into fighting forces and military groups.
But Salama says the publication also addresses what he calls the silent epidemic of violence,
which are issues such as female genital mutilation in parts of the region, and of course the widespread domestic and school-based violence that we still have in the region, including in Egypt.
He says it was a scholarly effort to analyze and integrate the Muslim and Christian Coptic religious texts.
I guess 4 years ago, the authors wouldn't have predicted the state of the region of today. But it couldn't be more timely in terms of what's happening across the Middle East and North Africa that now we have a joint Christian and Muslim publication really calling for protection of children from all forms of violence.
The UNICEF Regional Director for the MENA region calls the joint publication extremely significant.
The Al-Azhar University and Mosque and the Coptic Church of Egypt are very prominent institutions in their own right. And their influence can't be underestimated within Egypt alone, but actually also go far beyond Egypt. It's hugely significant, both symbolically but practically, that these great religions have joined forces to make such an important statement about children's rights.
To spread the word of the Peace, Love, Tolerance publication, UNICEF is using social media, along with traditional media of newspaper, radio, and TV.
So there are many technologies that are now used widely, particularly in urban areas, but even extending now to rural areas that are social media-based. We also want to really publicize these messages and make sure communities directly are also aware of really what their religious leaders are saying about the appropriateness or not of using harsh discipline, for example, at home or at schools, and also, of course, what the religious scholars say about sensitive issues such as female genital mutilation, which they're very clear about in these texts about the need to change.
Salama says at a time of increasing sectarianism in the Middle East and North Africa, Egypt's top religious leaders are using their moral compass on social values to give an optimistic message for the future. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Economic Forum on Africa is being held this week in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Over 1,200 political and business leaders are attending. Rwandan President Paul Kagame took part in a roundtable discussion on aid and investment. He said his decision to run for a third term was based on the demand of his people, although he thought about retiring.
I didn't ask for this thing at all. I was actually trying to tell my people that, you know what, there is room, you can find somebody else. Maybe you need to take a risk and look for somebody else. You are saying you can't let me go, you want me to stay because, you know, whatever the results you have had in the past. And I kept saying, no, we are not ready to take risks. We want you to stay. I said, but I'm having difficulties staying, and anyway, people outside have difficulties with me staying. So about thinking about that, they would say, well, but those same people from outside, when the country was on fire, burning almost to extinction, these fellows were just, in the end, it was like I was put in a cage. It's like, are you running away from this, or are you staying with us? So the debate was very healthy, and that's what it is. And maybe it's damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Agreeing with Mr. Kagame's decision on re-election is businessman and philanthropist Howard Buffett. His foundation has invested more than $500 million in Rwanda. He said investors want peace and stability, as well as a legal system that prosecutes corruption. Buffett, the son of billionaire Warren Buffett, said the Rwandan people voted to change the constitution to allow Mr. Kagame to seek another third term. He said President Kagame has his confidence and his support during a third term.
The bottom line is that if we didn't think President Kagame was going to be here for another 7 years, we wouldn't even consider doing what we're trying to do. That's the bottom line. And every democracy goes through challenges and changes. I mean, we've got 27 amendments to our Constitution. Constitutions can be amended. And I think what Rwanda did in this case, driven not by the president, but driven by almost a third of the country in petitions, I mean, in making a very strong statement about how they felt about their future. So, you know, I think about it in terms of, let's look at the results. The substance is that in 1994, the World Food Program estimated there were 800,000 people that were probably not going to survive without significant and quick food aid. Today, this country has pulled 3.5 million or more people out of poverty. That's substance, okay? So when I look at the results, I see no other answer other than this is what Rwandans want. They have proven it. They've done it themselves. They've made the statement, and there's a reason they've done it.
One of Buffett's next ideas for Rwanda is an agricultural institute inspired by the U.S. system of agricultural universities, began over 150 years ago. The institute would focus on education, research, and extension services to farmers.
The institute we want to build, it's not a university. It's a practical agricultural institute, which means that everybody that comes out of that institute will apply what they've learned in some form or another in this country in agriculture. And it could be in processing, it could be in agribusiness, but it could be on the farm, and it could be that, you know, you train mechanics and you train people how to use equipment and you train them different farming techniques. I mean, it's across the board. But that hasn't been done in a country that I'm aware of in the way that we're thinking of doing it. It's a big undertaking. I mean, but if there's one place we can do it, it's in Rwanda.
Mr. Kagame said partnerships with investors and donors are important for economic development, but foreign partners often put conditions on the support they give. The Rwandan president said Africans want greater ownership of development projects. That means a bigger say on how to use assistance. However, he added that Rwanda and its partners can monitor whether resources are being used properly and evaluate if the projects are meeting expectations.
South Africa's High Court gave the go-ahead today for as many as a half a million miners and ex-miners to file a class action suit against 32 gold mining companies. The miners say they contracted the lung disease, silicosis, and tuberculosis while working in those mines. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Historic is how Charles Abrahams, a lawyer representing the miners, describes the court's decision to allow South Africa's largest ever class action suit to proceed. He spoke to VOA from the steps of the South Gauteng High Court in Johannesburg shortly after the ruling.
I think that what this means is that law in the context of the social struggles of people, and particularly in this context, in mining communities, can play a very important role in advancing the struggles through rights litigation. And today we've seen that, you know, this is exactly what happens, you know, today.
A three-judge panel ruled Friday that hundreds of thousands of miners and their families can seek redress from some of the world's largest gold mining corporations after they contracted painful, often deadly lung diseases in the mines. The panel split the case into two classes, those who contracted silicosis and those who contracted tuberculosis. A group representing the mining firm said in a statement that the companies are studying the ruling and will decide individually whether to lodge an appeal. Abraham says he's confident of victory in the class action suit, but he notes today's victory is bittersweet. The case's original plaintiff, Tembekile Mankai, died of silicosis a week before the Constitutional Court ruled in 2011 to allow his precedent-setting case to proceed. That case developed into today's class action.
Hopefully, through today's judgment, Mrs. Mankai and Mr. Mankai's children and his dependents could look forward to some form of, you know, compensation from the mining company for which Mr. Mankai worked.
Abraham says this is not just a legal victory, but a social victory for South Africa's workers who have long fought for justice and equality during and after the racist apartheid regime. Taking the struggle from the streets to the courts, he says, is a sign of progress. The lawsuit, however it proceeds, is likely to have an economic impact. South Africa's statistical agency says that mining accounts for more than 8% of the nation's economy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there.
VOA.
On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.